From the studios of Farm Journal Broadcast, this is U.S. Farm Report.
Welcome to U.S. Farm Report this weekend. I'm Tyne Morgan, and here's what's in store over the next 60 minutes. As commodity prices catch fire,
well, there are people who think that we could legitimately run out of soybeans. I think the market will fix that problem through higher prices.
We'll explore what's driving the market's explosive action. Climbing corn prices pinch profits for ethanol producers as the oldest ethanol plant in the country calls it quits.
We think there are about two dozen that are completely idle today.
We'll explore the ethanol headwinds in 2021. A small act is going a long way.
We raised over $60,000.
How one farmer social media star is making a difference. And in John's world,
Rare Earths 102.
Now for the news, while commodities posted some of the biggest gains in 6.5 years this week, chaos unfolded in the nation's capital Wednesday, but equities and commodity markets largely shrugging off the turn of events. Just as Congress was debating the Electoral College votes, protesters entered into the Capitol. Hours later, Congress was able to get back to work, certifying Democrat Joe Biden's win over President Trump in the November election. President Trump denouncing the rioters, saying they don't represent the country and that a new administration will be inaugurated on January 20th. National Milk Producers Federation responding to Wednesday's actions, calling the violence an attack on democracy and saying that the insurrection put thousands of lives in danger in a brazen mob attempt to disrupt the peaceful transfer of power. Besides Democrats leading the executive branch, the Democrats also have majority now in both the U.S. House and the Senate. It follows both Georgia Senate runoff races being won this week by Democrats. And while a shift in a Senate leadership could have an impact on ag policy, farm groups like NCGA are optimistic about the next 4 years.
I have been in Washington since Ronald Reagan was president. So I've seen administrations come and I've seen administrations go. I have never, ever seen the kind of outreach to agriculture that I've seen with the Biden folks. And it isn't a one or two calls. It has been multiple calls at multiple levels across the board, many different organizations.
Well, U.S. commodities continuing the historic run in the new year with prices hitting levels producers haven't seen in 6.5 years. Prices for corn, soybeans, and bean meal all soaring at times this week. Pro Farmer reporting March futures pushed to the $5 mark in corn for the first time since May of 2014. But there were other factors pushing grains higher, including farm groups in Argentina announcing they'll stop grain sales for 3 days next week in protest of a new government mandate to suspend corn exports. Political unrest combined with falling production expectations in South America due to dry weather is also helping to keep a floor under both corn and soybeans.
519 is the next level when you look at the weekly continuation chart. If you push above that, then you got another level up. And there isn't a whole lot of resistance between that 519 and $6. And we saw it in the soybean market above $12. There wasn't a whole lot of resistance up to $13. And then once we pushed above $13, there isn't a whole lot of resistance for the next dollar up.
Soybeans are at the highest price level since July of 2014 and are edging even closer to the $14 mark, while soybean meal is also charging higher. And while corn prices did top $5 at one point this week, climbing corn prices is not good news for ethanol producers. Analysts say ethanol plants are facing some of the worst first quarter margins they've ever seen. Negative margins are forcing tough decisions, with the oldest ethanol plant in the country announcing this week it will quit producing ethanol. This letter going out to suppliers from a leader with Ingredion Incorporated, saying that it's ceasing production of ethanol at its Cedar Rapids location. The letter says market demand remains weak, and despite improvements to the production process, the plant was unable to achieve profitability. The facility will still be producing other corn products like starches. Analysts say this latest closing is just a sign of how difficult the market is today. Renewable Fuels Association says out of the 200 ethanol plants nationwide, they believe there are about two dozen that are completely idle and many more that have significantly reduced their production. We'll explore the road to recovery for ethanol coming up in our Farm Journal report. But it appears farmers are feeling better about things financially heading into the new year. That's according to a new Purdue University CME Group Ag Economy Barometer. The survey of farmer sentiments rose 7 points from November to a reading of 174 in December. That can be attributed to a rise in both the index of current conditions, which was up 15 points, and the index of future expectations, which increased by 5 points. The farm capital investment index rose to a record high of 93. Surveyors also asking about the future of trade. Well, another round of food aid will soon be making its way across the country. USDA announcing its plan to purchase an additional $1.5 billion of food to distribute as part of the Farmers to Families Food Box program. The fifth round of purchases is thanks to the more funding provided in the latest COVID relief bill approved by Congress and just signed by the president. Deliveries are expected to begin later this month and run through April. The first four rounds of the program to date has distributed 128 million boxes. All right, that's it for the news. Some snow and ice to start the new year. We'll get the latest look at the weather from Mike Kaufman next.
DeKalb congratulates our 2020 NCGA National Corn Yield Contest winners. Thank you for being champions of yield.
Well, time now for a check of weather with meteorologist Mike Kaufman. Mike, last weekend you gave us a long-term look at weather, but let's focus more on the shorter term this week. Areas of the plains and west are getting really dry.
Well, good morning to you, Tyne. And I don't see a lot of moisture for that area over the next 30 days or so. That's just the way it looks. You can see the really dry air, West Kansas, West Texas, all the way through California, with the worst areas, parts of Colorado, Utah, and also some southern areas, although that's been a slight improvement over the past couple of weeks, but still extremely dry. Still wet over parts of the Arkansas and surrounding states area, mid-Atlantic, somewhat in the western Great Lakes, although that area has turned drier, and you can see it kind of varies across the northern Rockies, also dry in the northeast. Let's take a look at the drought monitor, kind of the same areas, but the worst areas are definitely the four corner states, as well as West Texas, far West Texas especially, but there are dry areas farther east, even a small area there in Illinois into northern Indiana. Let's take a look at things then. We do have a change in the weather pattern coming. We've been talking about this for a while, but you can see a quick shot of Arctic air probably early this week, maybe into New England, but then things really start to kind of gel and come together. You can see by Wednesday a little bit of a system over the Great Lakes. That moves east, and boom, the Arctic air starts to come southward. How much cold air, how quickly, is still a little bit up in the air, but there is no doubt in my mind by Friday we'll be seeing it into the northern plains and the Great Lakes, and then it overtakes the northeast quadrant of the country, especially as we head through next weekend. And some of that obviously goes all the way to the Gulf Coast in this pattern when you see the air coming right off northwestern Canada by that point. Let's go day by day. On Monday, not a lot going on. Little system moving along the Gulf Coast, some rain, maybe a bit of snow in the hills of Arkansas. A little bit of rain and snow far northwest. Otherwise, dry pattern. Still dry on Wednesday. That first cold front is offshore of Florida. Next couple of systems, you can see a little bit of moisture with those, especially the second one coming into the Pacific Northwest. And by Friday, that's all moving through the Great Lakes. Frigid air starting to come southward. We'll just call it cold, though, over the middle of the country for now. Still pretty mild in the southeast. And it starts to warm up in the northwestern portions of the country. Now, the 30-day outlook for temperatures, it's going to start over the next 10 days or so, going to be warm over most of this area and cold down here. But I think that all flip-flops and we end up above normal, East Coast, Southeast, Southern Plains, and most of the West, and the below-normal air starting to take over the northern plains into Canada. Precipitation, I'm going above normal, mid Mississippi Valley into the northeast, northwest northern Rockies, below normal southwest, and probably in south central parts of Canada. Tyne?
Thanks, Mike. Well, weather in South America seems to be fueling the markets. And after a historic run in commodity prices this week, what's the main driver and could this be a rally that lasts? Joe Vaklovic and Mike North join me next. Welcome back. Well, Joe Vaklovic and Mike North are joining me this weekend. What a wild ride we've seen with these commodity prices. Joe, I'm going to start with you. I mean, we're looking at 6.5-year highs. What is driving this thing right now?
Well, we certainly have some of the better fundamentals in the grain markets, especially in the case of soybeans, corn maybe to a lesser extent. Some of the better fundamentals that we've seen in many years. You know, there are people who think that we could legitimately run out of soybeans. I think the market will fix that problem through higher prices, reduced crush margins, that sort of thing. In corn, we had a much lighter 2020 crop than most people had anticipated. We've seen much better export business than people had anticipated. So you've certainly got some supply and demand factors. You've also got some other factors. Large money managers are very aggressively long these markets. They've been bidding up the grain markets for months now. And I think that has something to do with the weaker dollar, maybe some inflationary fears, things along those lines.
Yeah, so let's talk to the money flow side of it, Mike, because we know it's more than just fundamentals at play right now. And so what does that typically mean for a market? I mean, could these go significantly higher as we see this money flow come in?
Well, the big question right now is how much money do they have? You know, as you look at their position, they are holding a record length in corn. And when you look at a size of position like they have on right now, you wonder how much more can they go? Will this old number serve as a little bit of a high watermark for them, and will they be shaken out by any sort of slight change in news? You know, the real question really is how much money do they have? And with the amount of stimulus that's floated into this market in the course of the last year by way of different packages from the government, nobody really has a great answer for that. So I think as we go forward, we'll be testing that water to see how interested they are. I think Joe raises a great point with regard to inflationary concerns. We really saw them dive into that conversation as treasuries tapered off in October and new money rolled into our market. So will they continue on that front, and will they see this as an ongoing play given the amount of, you know, the trillions of dollars that have moved into this market in the course of the last 6 months?
Yeah, I mean, Joe, markets raced higher, went much higher, much faster than a lot of folks anticipated. Here we sit this week. Corn prices did hit $5 briefly, but as we move through the remainder of this year, do you think $5 corn is something we are going to be talking about all year? Is that realistic?
It's realistic, but you would need a number of things to happen. We need to get ethanol back in business, and there are major problems there. We may need to see some sort of weather issue, lower than trend yields this year in the United States. You know, we do have a drought that's in the western part of the United States that's working its way east. It's already in parts of the western Corn Belt. I don't believe it's too early to talk about that. You know, fast forward a couple of months, that could be a big concern if it's not alleviated. So yeah, it's possible, but you do need the right things to happen. And I cannot overstate the influence of this large speculative or institutional money in the markets. It just seems to be endless. I mean, you look at the grain markets, you look at the stock market, you look at some of these other assets that have become inflated, everything from real estate to used trucks to land. I mean, everything is becoming inflated. It just seems like the money out there that's willing to chase these assets is just limitless at this point. And we know it's not totally limitless, and we know that this doesn't last forever, but it's a big deal right now, in my opinion.
Yeah, Mike, next week we're going to get USDA's final look at crop production as we look at those reports that are going to be released Tuesday. What do we need to see out of those reports for prices to hold at these levels?
Well, we're already pricing in and expecting reductions. Average analyst guess out there on the street right now is that we move ending stocks on corn down to about 1.6 billion and soybeans to about 140 million. That's the average target that's laid out there today. I'd say to really fire this thing up further, you're going to have to do a little bit more than that, because if all you show is what we expect, that's already in the market. And then it becomes a question of how interested everybody is in going further with their long position. So to get the market fired up, I think you're going to have to better that reduction, maybe show some deeper losses in the South American complex, maybe show some increases on the demand side of the balance sheet. But, you know, frankly, with the average guess we have in the water right now, I don't see that we're going to raise the bar all too much following that report.
All right, what about end users? We'll talk about that in our next roundtable this weekend on U.S. Farm Report.
It starts with a plan. That's why America's Conservation Ag Movement is inviting you to get your farm business ready for 2021 with a free resource stewardship planning guide. Get your free guide today at agweb.com/ACAM.
Well, it's time now to check in with John Phipps, where he has a rare topic on his mind this week. John?
Okay, back before Christmas, I took off on a tangent about rare earth elements, or REEs. These nearly unpronounceable later additions to the periodic table have become incredibly important for the future of technology, and as a result, for our economic and political futures. Okay, maybe they won't be the oil of the 21st century, but they will be keys to how fast and close we can come to zero emissions. REEs are crucial to forging permanent magnets, which have revolutionized electric motor construction and efficiency. Ag has been a big beneficiary of this development, from those tiny motors on drones to planter drives. Permanent magnets replace entire gearboxes in wind turbines and whole transmissions in Teslas. They are the reasons new washers wind up to those scary speeds to spin dry clothes. Old asynchronous motors, in comparison, have a choice of one speed and are really, really heavy. These new, highly efficient and versatile motors will do for mechanical power what LEDs have done for lighting. Consequently, the demand for REEs, especially neodymium, which I highlighted last time, is expected to jump dramatically. Other REEs, such as dysprosium, used in hard drives and lasers, are also needed more in bulk. In fact, the electric vehicle market alone could explode not just the use of REEs, but several other minerals like nickel and aluminum. This chart from Bloomberg suggests demand increases of over 10 times over the next decade for many minerals. But please note, it was created by a mining stock market analyst. There's little doubt that the near and foreseeable future will be increasingly less about fossil fuels and more about electricity. While this would seem to be good news for carbon emissions and climate change, there are some significant trade-offs. The largest obstacle for this better future, however, is economic and global politics. This chart shows why. It's just another friction point between China and not just the U.S., but the rest of the world. China owns global REE production. Okay, I know this series is not too exciting for many of you, but I'll wrap it up next week with a look at this problem right here, China's current dominance in REE production. What the U.S. could do to reduce what is being seen as a strategic weakness, and why taking those actions could be a big mistake.
Thanks, John. And when we come back, Tractor Tales with Machinery Pete.
Hey, welcome back to Tractor Tales, folks. This week we're off to Ohio to check out a Plymouth, which was made right in Ohio and was the last of its kind before the Silver King. And all those tractors were made right in Plymouth, Ohio.
It's a 1934 Plymouth. It went to Horsehead, New York. That's where I bought it out of. Had to put new tires on it after I bought it. These are ridge tires on the front and turf tires on the rear. The serial number is number 11. They started at 100. This is 111.
We were happy to be able to bring it home to where it was manufactured. I never thought my husband would ever own a Silver King or a Plymouth tractor because he had one when he was growing up on his dad's farm that he farmed with.
But we got the horse head, $10,000, and I hadn't got a bid on it yet. My wife says, what are you gonna do? And I looked at her. She said, well, we come after the tractor. So that opened the door.
When our children and grandchildren came home, a lot of times they would get the tractors out of the barn. They'd go around the barn, ride them, you know, around the barn or down the lane and back. And so they've had a lot of fun.
Well, as gasoline demand remains weak, higher corn prices are not helping ethanol producers already facing pinched profits. When we come back, we'll explore the road to recovery for ethanol in 2021 and the difficult dilemma many ethanol producers are facing.
U.S. Farm Report is produced and distributed by Farm Journal Broadcast. Welcome back to U.S. Farm Report. Trusted, timely, tradition.
Well, over the next several weeks leading up to Commodity Classic, we'll explore the issues and opportunities facing corn farmers today, from conservation to feed users to demand. And on the demand front, this week we're looking into the road to recovery for ethanol in 2021 and beyond. As commodity prices continue to catch fire in the new year,
this rally is one on will be going down as probably the most longest and biggest rally we've had during this time period.
Corn prices topped the $5 mark this week, a welcome sign for farmers, but not good news for ethanol producers.
And really for our industry, the road to recovery from COVID, we think is a long road and it's full of potholes. And we're actually worried about hitting some of those potholes in the weeks ahead.
As the ethanol industry continues to recover from the impacts COVID-19 is having on gasoline demand, climbing corn prices aren't helping.
We've seen margins in the last few weeks go negative in some geographies, and that's just not sustainable.
Just this week, the oldest ethanol plant in the country decided to call it quits. Ingredion in Cedar Rapids cited declining margins and weak demand as the reasons it would stop producing ethanol.
Out of the 200 ethanol plants nationwide, we think there are about two dozen that are completely idle today. And probably that many more that have significantly reduced their production rates.
And Growth Energy says other ethanol producers are facing a similar dilemma.
I have plants that never opened back up since they shut down because of COVID, and I've got plants that are going to have to really curtail their production and maybe close down for a period because of the soft demand right now.
RFA says fuel consumption today is 10 to 15% below a year ago, a major hurdle for U.S. ethanol producers.
We don't really expect ethanol demand to approach pre-pandemic levels until the vaccine is widespread and the existing lockdowns are lifted.
As the race to get America vaccinated is underway, Peter Meyer of S&P Global Platts says the road to recovery for ethanol could be another year out.
My crystal ball doesn't really see us getting back to pre-pandemic levels probably for another year or so. So I would say Q4 and then going into Q1 of 2022. Once everybody feels comfortable, and once we also feel comfortable with the fact that enough people have been vaccinated against COVID.
And as more people stay at home, ethanol producers are facing a situation similar to what they saw last spring.
Look at these ending stocks numbers. I mean, this is a problem. This is a 7-month high here just this week at 22.95 million barrels. And you look at this growth over the last 4 weeks.
A concern for the industry and an even bigger concern for ethanol producers watching stocks pile up.
I've talked to several members just in the past 24 hours that if they haven't already started to slow down, they will in the next few days or weeks because we've just got an oversupply of ethanol right now.
National Corn Growers Association says 2020 was a double whammy for demand loss.
Nearly 5 billion gallons of ethanol demand destroyed because of the small refinery exemptions. Another 2 billion gallons of demand that we've lost since March.
But as the corn market shrugs off the demand destruction taking place, Growth Energy also has hope a recovery is possible for ethanol this year.
So we need people to start moving again. We need the economy to open back up. We saw some of that in the summer, so we need that to recover. And I think our optimism comes from hope that the vaccine is going to make its way quickly through the United States and elsewhere as well.
RFA says with more people working from home indefinitely and changing travel habits, there's a strong possibility some of the demand will never come back. But Cooper says there's also offsetting factors that could be good for ethanol demand.
We know mass transit in the larger urban areas is down. People are not taking the subways and metros. They're driving their cars into work. And we actually see some major cities, places like New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, where there is kind of an exodus of the population from those very densely populated city centers kind of into the suburbs. And that all results in greater vehicle traffic.
The changing habits aren't just taking place in the U.S. Meyer says COVID-19 is changing the way goods are consumed around the globe.
Ukraine has had a bad corn crop. Really, they export a lot of corn to the EU. There just isn't demand there for ethanol because they're under the same lockdown structure that we are here in the U.S.
As ethanol's road to recovery seems bumpy, Renewable Fuels Association says there is one major factor that could give ethanol a needed boost.
Well, we think the biggest shot in the arm that the ethanol market could get is, you know, reopening of the export market.
And he says China is at the top of that list.
China was once our third leading export market, and we're sending very little ethanol to China today because of a tariff that remains in place in that market.
And the second major market mover for exports is Brazil.
Our relationship with Brazil and ethanol goes back 30, 40 years, and it's always been weird, and there's always been disruptions. And, you know, when we had, you know, tariffs on Brazilian ethanol and they retaliated, and you know, it's been back and forth. I think that we can resolve this issue with Brazil, but it's a tough one.
Just last month, Brazil announced all U.S. ethanol imports would face a 20% tariff, a move Cooper says severely constrains the United States' ability to export there.
We're looking for a new administration to really help us, you know, reestablish the free and fair trade relationships that we had with these markets. And really jumpstart our export program as we head into 2021.
More than just China and Brazil, Doggett says exports to other countries could also fill the gaps.
In Mexico, if we could get the Mexicans to accept ethanol in the three largest cities in Mexico, that's a huge market. India has a lot of potential. Vietnam has a lot of potential.
And as the headwinds for ethanol seem to mount, there's still hope 2021 will be a better year.
Well, it's not just gasoline demand impacting corn farmers. Next weekend, we'll look into why optimism is sprouting over what a new administration could mean for the renewable fuel standard, as well as the small refinery waivers that have been issued. All right, coming up next, the corn market seems to be shrugging off the issues with ethanol. We'll look into that, plus get into the feed user side. That's next.
BEX is proud to serve a community of farmers who love what they do and who are proud to be farmers at heart.
Welcome back to U.S. Farm Report. Well, we just finished talking about the road to recovery for ethanol in 2021. And Joe, right now it's not looking good. We had Growth Energy tell us, you know, there's a lot of ethanol producers right now looking at negative margins, looking at possibly slowing down production. But it doesn't seem like the corn market cares about that fundamental right now. Why?
Yeah, it's really kind of interesting. You look at the corn market, which has been phenomenally strong, and you would never know that the single biggest segment of your demand base is in serious, serious trouble. Spot ethanol margins and forward ethanol margins are essentially universally negative across the Corn Belt. Given spot margins, current margins, there's probably not a plant in the United States that could achieve profitability. Now, they'll keep grinding corn because a lot of them may have locked in margins previously. Maybe they have other businesses that can keep them afloat. Every plant is different. There's a lot of variability. But this is a big problem. And keep in mind, we have lost, as a result of COVID, essentially, we have lost gasoline demand and corn demand via the ethanol industry every single week since basically February.
Yeah, and you know, that's demand we're not going to recover. And the ethanol industry is saying, listen, if we want to inject, you know, some momentum into this ethanol market, we need to see exports grow. But when you look at what's happening here domestically, Mike, when do you think the corn market does start to care?
Well, I think as we come into a new presidency, I think that'll become a little bit more of a focal point with all the talk of a potential nationwide mask mandate, potential shutdowns, kind of following on the footsteps of the UK. There's certainly a threat there that people are going to be pushed back into their houses maybe a little bit longer, and that really will become more of a conversation point. You know, as Joe pointed out, there's variability among these plants. Those dry mills certainly are feeling it a lot harder than the wet mills. And as we go forward with any given talk about a nationwide shutdown, we'll bring fuel consumption back front and center to the discussion. And some of these big plays that we've seen in terms of exports and potential talk of Production cuts will be likely more than offset by losses in ethanol without some sort of price balancing.
All right, switching from the end users of ethanol to livestock. Joe, last weekend on the show, when we had our outlook and what to expect in 2021, you know, our analyst said, listen, expect better cattle prices probably in the second half of the year. Pork, not so much, probably because we could see exports taper off because China may have fulfilled their need. Do you agree with that?
In regard to pork, we know that China is aggressively rebuilding their hog herd following that African swine fever deal, which wiped out at one point like half of the hog herd in China. So I could buy that argument that exports will be reduced. Cattle is one of the markets that's interesting to me because it really hasn't seen the big inflow of speculative money like you've seen in some other commodity markets, like say the grain markets, maybe the precious metals. If we could get some slightly better looking fundamentals there, that's a market that could be a candidate for some of this big speculative money. And the cattle producer could certainly use it with these cattle prices that are kind of under pressure and feed costs that continue to rise.
Mike, what about dairy? As we see the announcement of Farmers to Families food boxes, another round, milk futures responding positively, up limit, it seems, when that announcement comes out. Do you think these type of prices, though, are sustainable into 2021 if we don't see more announcements like that?
Absolutely. And even as you look at the forward curve, the market tapers off pretty hard as you get through March, April. And really, even on days where we've seen limit and double limit moves, some of those months beyond that point or even trading negative, to really coincide with everything you're saying. Without a government bid in this market, we have to return back to the normal players, the normal routines, the normal flows. And let's just face it, if we're shutting down the economy in any capacity or keeping people at home, you don't get that food service rebound that everybody is really counting on to bring us back to the normal flow of products. So all the way around, without a government bid, this market is very, very susceptible to downside risk.
All right, Joe, Mike, thank you so much for joining us this weekend. We need to take a quick break, and then we'll have much more right here on U.S. Farm Report.
DeKalb congratulates our 2020 NCGA National Corn Yield Contest winners. Thank you for being champions of yield.
Well, we know many of you are itching to get out and travel the countryside once again. Well, Andrew McRae is traveling the countryside this weekend with American Countryside.
The old drugstore in Allerton, Iowa dates to the late 1800s. While Ross and Lorena Blunt had visited the store many times over the years, they got a chance to purchase it in its second century of operation.
And we said, oh, we mustn't let this go. We mustn't have just one more empty storefront, totally stripped with broken windows, making us look dead.
That was back in 2008. The couple had witnessed the closing of the local feed and grain store, forcing them to drive further for their farm supplies. So when the drugstore was up for sale, they knew this was about much more than one business. It was about saving their town.
We said, anybody that's interested, meet at the gazebo, and we're going to just say, what can we do to do something about this? And there were five of us that showed up.
The mayor, a local business owner, a Head Start teacher, they were a few of those who gathered and eventually set up a nonprofit board to purchase, renovate, and operate the store. This was a place many had flocked to over the decades, and it would once again serve that purpose.
We really wanted a place where kids could gather, where adults could gather, and children could play games. So there's something for everybody.
The centerpiece is the restored soda fountain that serves up treats to folks of all ages.
It was in very bad condition. It was rusty inside. It's the original 1952, but it's either been replaced or like stainless steel put in where it had rusted through.
The group has worked to recreate the entire experience. Richard Henderson, a graduate of the old high school and a retired pharmacist, brought his vintage pharmacy collection here as well.
The antacid section was a very big section. They must have had a lot of stomach problems back in the 20s and 30s or constipation, because that's a large part of what was in a pharmacy.
You can find just about anything on these shelves. Some names are familiar, others are from the past, and still others, well, you wonder what the product was even designed to treat. A group of volunteers has enjoyed bringing the place back to life and giving back to the community.
It's not good to be mired in the past, but here the history of the place has created a wonderful gathering spot for the present, creating memories now and in the future. Traveling the countryside in Allerton, Iowa, I'm Andrew McCray.
Well, Andrew says the volunteers are hopeful that the store will open later this year when COVID cases aren't as high and we see the return to warmer weather. When we come back, John turns his focus to safety.
It's Safety Sunday.
Well, John Phipps has his sights set on safety this week.
Well, we have two safety comments this morning from Gary Woodruff in Rossville, Indiana. I would really like to see some discussion on the misuse of the SMV sign. I learned many years ago, in fact, in 1971 during 4-H tractor maintenance meetings, that it was critical that the SMV signs only be used on slow-moving vehicles. It bothers me today as I travel to see the SMV sign used to mark house driveway entrances at the road, on a local school's bus terminal to mark the entrance gate, and other inexplicable places. Gary, I agree wholeheartedly, but I actually think they may be misused less often now than when they first came out. It seems to me that when the newer, vastly improved reflection materials took over, dedicated reflectors like SMV emblems became way more expensive and people just cut back on their misuse. My big gripe with SMV signs is having them on equipment that exceeds 25 miles an hour, which has a similar dilution of the safety effect. And from Roger Voles in North Liberty, Iowa, an observation I've been expecting for years. I noticed this time in your shop that your table saw was prevalent in the picture. I listened to you while looking at your table saw. I noticed that the blade was above the tabletop and had no safety guard on it. I realized that you were not operating the saw at the time, but not having the guard in place sends the wrong message to many viewers, especially if there are younger ones watching. Roger, I plead absolutely guilty, and while I'm not making excuses, there are reasons I do not use the saw blade cover. First, it's really hard to take on and off, especially with an outfeed table like mine. Second, they can only be used with through cuts, and you have to remove them for grooves or dados. Third, even the best of them limit visibility. Finally, from New Yankee Workshop to the Woodsmith TV show, experts are omitting them as well and no longer even pretend by saying that the guard has been removed for video purposes. I recognize the enormous risks a table saw presents and do take other measures. I have non-slip footing. I have push sticks close at hand, a knee bump shutoff, and most important in my opinion, a splitter, which is like a riving knife to reduce kickback. When grandchildren are here, I routinely shut breakers to the major tools off and do lower the saw blade. I've also trained myself not to reach around the blade, and I unplug it when I'm changing the blades. All safety devices have a cost-benefit ratio, but the table saw blade guard is a questionable trade-off, in my opinion.
Thanks, John. And speaking of safety, one YouTube star saw the need for more grain bin safety tools on the farm and for fire departments. So he jumped in, and his generosity is now being spread to various states. We'll have that story next.
America's Conservation Ag Movement, a national partnership to help farmers scale conservation for their businesses, the environment, and their communities. To learn more, visit agweb.com/ACAM.
Well, he has 707,000 YouTube subscribers, and his YouTube videos have been viewed 163 million times. And in 2020, he decided to use his platform to give back.
We decided kind of right before harvest started that there's an obvious need in the upper Midwest.
Had some comments in my last video about the disc blades being up.
Zach Johnson, known as the millennial farmer on social media, says that need sparked an idea.
Last year we had poor quality corn throughout the upper Midwest here, and it caused a lot of issues inside grain bins. So we decided that we wanted to do what we could and use our platform to try to raise some money for local volunteer fire departments and first responders who work in these rural areas and work with farmers and live with farmers every day. And when that equipment is needed, you know, as farmers, we need it to be there.
They started raising funds through GoFundMe, but as he put out more videos, the support just poured in.
We raised over $60,000. And last week we mailed out, I believe it was 51 checks to 51 different departments in 13 states.
He says the money came from not just viewers, but companies like Sukup, a grain bin manufacturer, who wanted to help.
It's humbling. We've done this before, but on the type of scale that it was and the way that it took off, where we allowed the viewers to go to a link and specifically donate themselves, it really showed like what we can do and what that platform can do, what the viewers can do.
A humble gesture from a farmer turned YouTube star who's determined to make a difference, spreading generosity from state to state.
Using social media for good. What a great story, Zach. Thanks. All right, that does it for this weekend. Thank you so much for joining us. Be sure to join us next weekend as we work to build on our tradition. Have a great weekend, everyone.
U.S. Farm Report is produced and distributed by Farm Journal Broadcast.